If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Hello and welcome to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine, Britain's best-selling history magazine. I'm Ellie Cawthorne, and for our podcast today, we've got a conversation with the historian Charles Emerson. Charles's most recent book is Crucible, The Long End of the Great War and the Birth of a New World, 1917 to 1924. And it chronicles the global tumult that followed in the wake of the First World War, from the collapse of four huge empires to the rise of extreme new political ideologies. It's a period that was to shape the rest of the 20th century. BBC World History's editor, Matt Elton, spoke to Charles in our studio in Bristol to find out more.
So your new book is a study of the years between 1917 and 1924, which is obviously quite a big dynamic period of history. How did you approach covering this period, and why did you make that decision?
Well, I wrote this book basically in the present tense. And what I was trying to do that way is to convey a sense of immediacy and a sense of possibility, and to try and follow the biographies of certain characters through these years from 1917 to 1924, and sort of lay it out as if it were essentially almost like a screenplay, a film script. And what I wanted by that is for the reader to first get a sense of the immediacy and possibility in those years, a sense that it wasn't actually entirely, it wasn't entirely clear how the future would play out, but to really situate them in the times. Mm. And so what I've done throughout the book is I've got quite short entries going, year by year and then season by season, from 1917 through to 1924. You know, the shortest would be just a couple of lines describing a situation of maybe a few minutes, maybe a few hours. You know, the very longest is a couple of pages. So there's that sort of diaristic approach to it. And hopefully that will draw the reader in, and they can read it really as they like. They can read it perhaps a little bit like a novel. But also it means that if they're particularly interested in one character or one particular place, then if they come across a place or character they're less interested in, they can sort of skip over that a bit and choose which narrative they're going to devote their time to as a reader.
Mm. I was surprised by exactly how striking that approach is. Can you give us an example of how it works?
Well, I can read out the very first entry for the book, which is in the deep winter of 1917 in Petrograd in Russia. And that'll give you a sense of how I'm doing it from the get-go. So this is winter 1917 in Petrograd, Russia. It is a lurid affair. The press, though heavily censored, have a field day. A popular hate figure, a holy man accused of hijacking the imperial family, cuckolding the Tsar, and leading Russia to ruin, has been murdered by one of Russia's most prominent aristocrats. Rasputin's mutilated body is laid to rest in the foundations of a new church at Tsarskoye Selo, the Tsar's estate just outside Petrograd. Nicholas Romanov is there, his German-born wife Alexandra, and their four daughters. Their son Alexei is too ill to attend. Boards are placed on the ground to protect their clothes from the frozen mud. Alexandra is in tears. Russia is in crisis. The price of bread and apples and cabbage and underwear and everything else keeps going up. The soldiers' boots are worn out. There are rumours of a possible palace coup. The French ambassador is told of plans to assassinate the Tsarina. Nicholas is tired. He prays fervently for salvation. So that's the, you know, and then I carry that through the book, which I have to say was quite a, it was quite a frightening choice to make in terms of writing a history book where you're writing it in the present tense. But I hope it works.
Yeah.
And I think it gives that sense of, you know, I want to put people there. Because after all, we're describing a set of very, very complex events. And rather than going through a whole ream of statistics or acronyms, I think one way of trying to convey that story is through, you know, getting people emotionally invested in the characters.
Something that interests me is how you decided how to focus on the scale, like what proportion of the narrative to spend in different places, how much to write about each entry. I mean, how complex was that as a process?
It's a very difficult process because you're trying, you can't expect the reader to spend too much time on one particular subject, one particular area. So I didn't want any entry to be more than really, you know, two or three pages. But then, of course, there is the ordering and how things fit together. And sometimes, very often, in fact, you would find, you know, a nice dovetailing of stories where you might find that one person is talking, for example, about something happening in Vienna, and then you can shift the scene. You know, the next scene can be Vienna, so that you can find these various through lines in writing the book. But you know, hopefully that comes across as relatively seamless. But it's very tough to put it together.
Talking about those through lines, this is obviously a period in which there's a huge amount happening. What do you think connects it thematically? Would you say?
Chaos and reordering of the world, essentially, because we start in 1917, and there, you know, we're starting in Petrograd, 1917, murder of Rasputin, but the Russian Empire is still there. Nicholas is still the Tsar. By the end of that year, you know, Nicholas is overthrown. The Russian Empire is no more; it's on the point of collapse, and Europe itself is in tumult. And then through the course of the years from 1917 to 1924, you have this almost, you know, constant set of events of civil wars, of revolutions, of cultural upheavals, social upheavals, economic upheavals. And it's only really by 1924 that begins to settle, or Europe gives the impression of having settled. And I think this is a really critical period in modern history. And, you know, in Britain, we tend to focus on 1918 being the end of the First World War, Armistice Day, you know, November the 11th, 1918. But in reality, if you were in most other parts of Europe, indeed other parts of the British Isles, in Ireland, for example, then the war didn't end in 1918 at all. It simply mutated into these other sets of convulsions and political upheavals.
Is it fair to say that at the heart of this story is the collapse of four massive empires?
Yes. I mean, again, if we go back to 1917, the Russian Empire, at that time, at the beginning of 1917, I think it was, people would have generally thought that if peace came and people were hoping that peace would come in 1917, that in a way the world that had existed before the war could have been somehow reanimated, recreated, brought back to life, or maybe things would just continue as they had been before, and those empires would survive. Again, by the end of 1917, that no longer seems to be the case. The Russian Empire is already gone. In Vienna, people are very worried about the future of the Habsburg Empire. The German Empire also is on its knees. And so with that sense of an old world being swept away and the possibilities of destruction, there's also the possibilities of recreation and what emerges from the fires of war. And so you set up a very, very interesting tension between those who are on their way out in 1917, 1918, 1919, and those who see opportunity in the disorder and chaos and try to create a new world out of the ashes of the old.
Do you think there are people then who were very consciously aware of the fact this was a period in which new kind of orders could be created? Was it that conscious?
Yes, I think it absolutely is. I think it is absolutely that conscious. You know, one of the other characters which I follow through the book is Vladimir Lenin. And we meet him quite early on in the book in Zurich, where he's living above a butcher's shop. And, you know, is this he's this émigré who's not particularly well known, even in you know, even in Russia, even in socialist circles in Russia or worker circles in Russia. And there's some doubt as to whether he'll ever return to Russia, and certainly whether he'll ever lead a worldwide socialist revolution. And yet, the events which occur in the course of that year, 1917, suddenly put him into a position to actually to affect his dream. And so that there is a sense in these years, and it's not just, of course, to do with Vladimir Lenin, but there is this sense that yes, these are particular times. And in a way, there's an urgency to it, that the chaos of the times and the possibility of the times must be grasped. So there's a lot of energy behind a lot of these characters, because they think this is their moment, and their moment may not last very long. And the same could be said of, for example, Woodrow Wilson. You know, the United States joins the war in 1917, and Woodrow Wilson is fired up with this notion that this is America's opportunity, and particularly his opportunity, to recreate the world in almost in the image, or his sort of his received image, or his ideal image of America.
There are some huge characters here, and something I like is the fact that because we follow them through the book, you almost see them in a new light, because you're tracing their careers as the book evolves. Is there anyone who you came to see in a different way because of writing this book, or anyone that you'd like readers to view differently?
Well, I think it's very, very important to follow these trajectories through the book, because there are so many big characters like Mussolini, like Lenin, like Hitler, like Freud, like Einstein. These are big names. And we tend to view them as if they were, first of all, we tend to view their trajectories as if they were sort of developing almost in isolation from one another, whereas in fact they weren't, because they were often looking over their shoulders at each other, and in some ways learning from each other. But also there's a sense in which they're learning on the job as they go along, which I think is instructive for how political ideologies develop and how political careers are developed or fail. You know, one prime example of that is Adolf Hitler, who is of course a major character in the book, and who I follow from 1917, when he's a field runner on the Western Front, through to 1924, when he gets out of Landsberg jail, having been imprisoned for his part in the Munich Putsch. And I think it's important to see this political figure actually trying out, for example, in Munich in 1920, 1921, trying out different political lines on his audience, and seeing the way in which there's an interrelationship between the various ideologies he's picked up, the scraps of ideas he's picked up from various sorts over the years, and how that's slowly being formed into what becomes the ideology of the Nazi Party.
Going back to Wilson, who you mentioned there, what was the experience for America of the end of the First World War, and how should we understand that to understand this period?
Well, on the one hand, of course, you know, America joins the war in 1917, 1918, victory comes, and a large part of that is due to the American contribution. So there's a sense that this is America's, you know, grand entry in a way into world affairs, and America's prestige is running very, very high. And so, of course, is Woodrow Wilson's personal prestige running tremendously high, which is why when he comes to Europe at the end of 1918 to participate in the peace conference in Paris, you know, he really believes that he can remake the world. So that's one part of it. But another part of it is that after the war, you have an economic crisis in the United States. And this isolationist, nativist, anti-immigrant streak, a streak that's afraid of communism, what's happening, the chaos in Europe being transported across the sea back to the United States, that's also very, very strong. So you see an initial sense of, you know, America's prestige very, very high in the world, but also this fear in the United States that actually America is at risk, that it's vulnerable. That, you know, a Bolshevik revolution could occur in some form in the United States. You get this pushback in the form of, first of all, in the form of the Red Scare in 1919, where there's a there's after Woodrow Wilson has fallen ill, he's essentially out of commission, has a stroke. You have a very activist attorney general who's trying to lock up all foreign radicals and indeed expel foreign radicals from the United States, and this tremendous fear of revolution. But then you also have, a little bit later on, and linked to that, you have a new policies on immigration which exclude or vastly reduce the amount of immigration which the United States will accept in the future. And so you sort of have U.S. history, if you like, going into reverse. There's one particular episode which I think is very powerful, which is the expulsion of foreign radicals on the USAT Burford in December 1919 after the various radicals have been rounded up in this sort of dragnet operation, and then 230-odd are expelled to Russia, I think around Christmas Eve, I think it is, on 1919. And for me, there's something quite compelling in the notion of these individuals, mostly of Eastern European origins, being sent to Ellis Island and then being sent to Russia, which is almost exactly the US history of the 19th century in reverse, where, of course, America was the country, or the United States was the nation greeting the refugees from Europe. And this goes into reverse in this era.
Still to come on the History Extra podcast.
If you're imagining a world where you think that sort of the train lines, the tram lines or the train lines are set, the world is going to progress, you know, along this future. It's already laid out. And then what happens in 1917, 1918, basically the train lines buckle. You've got no idea where you're going. And that chaos creates opportunity.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Another aspect of the US in this period, of course, is its treatment of race and racial sort of tensions. What did your book reveal to you about that story?
Well, this is a tremendously important period for race in the United States and indeed across the world. And what happens in the United States is you have African American soldiers who have fought in France. They come back to the United States, and there is this real sense that they've paid their dues to American society, that simply waiting for American society to respect the rights of its black citizens is no longer acceptable. And this becomes the war and the experience of the war becomes really the starting point for the Harlem Renaissance. And for this idea that actually the time has come for African Americans to claim their rights rather than to just wait for them to somehow drop from the sky. On the other hand, this is also a period when the Ku Klux Klan becomes stronger and stronger and stronger, where this sort of nativist streak of white America comes more to the fore. And so race, 50 years after the Civil War, you know, race comes back into the foreground. It's never really gone away, but comes back into the real foreground of American politics.
Moving from one superpower to another, if you like, is it fair to say this is a story dominated by Russia and the actions of that nation?
Well, I wouldn't say it doesn't completely dominate, but yes, it's a very large part of the book because Russia is at the origins of the revolution, which provides quite a lot of motive force for the hopes and fears that people have in Europe and indeed in America at this time. But also, of course, because the Russian Empire collapses, and that leaves, there's a civil war which follows from that, and that leaves really chaos across Eurasia, and different parties who see the opportunities that they can, you see opportunities in that. So, for example, you have as one of these sort of secondary conflicts, which comes after 1918. You have Western intervention in the Russian Civil War, which is often sort of forgotten, but it's an absolutely fascinating episode of Russian, indeed world history. And you also have, and this is something quite important for today as well, is you have the brief emergence of an independent Ukraine. And, you know, looking at the current situation in Eastern Europe, indeed the current situation in Ukraine, Ukrainians look back to this period as being a very, very important sort of first try at statehood, if you like. Russia is absolutely a big part of the narrative. And also, to be entirely frank, any student of history will know that, and particularly Russian history will know, it just provides lots and lots and lots of examples of huge, absurd, tragic, heroic experiences. And I try to convey as much of that as I can in the book. The sheer scale of what's going on in Russia at that time.
This is a period that sees the sort of emergence and the growth of a whole set of ideologies, fascism, communism, all of them. Why do you think it was such a hotbed for this kind of political ideology?
Well, I think it's, you know, when you have a completely chaotic period, when you have a time where, if you're imagining a world where you think that sort of the train lines, the tram lines or the train lines are set, the world is going to progress, you know, along this future. It's already laid out. And then what happens in 1917, 1918, basically the train lines buckle. You've got no idea where you're going. And that chaos creates opportunity, and it creates a sense of, a sense of the possible. It creates space for these very unlikely characters, such as Hitler, such as Lenin. You know, you could even include Freud in that. I think, you know, he's this rather eccentric, mushroom-picking Austrian doctor. And by 1924, he's considered to be a great superstar who's unlocked the secrets of the subconscious. This churn and this chaos creates opportunities for new ideologies to emerge. And I think one thing which is very interesting about that is that although we tend to view, you know, fascism and communism as developing, or surrealism for that matter, or psychoanalysis as sort of such big cultural events or ideologies, that we tend to view them almost in isolation, as if they developed just along on their own steam. In fact, what you see in this period is their exponents, their leaders, looking at each other, learning from each other in terms of tactics, in terms of strategy, and also in terms of the development of their ideas. So I think it's useful to look at them together.
Are there any other individuals who you think you'd like to see the importance of foregrounded more than it has been?
Well, I think there are certain characters who, because they failed, because they were less successful, they tend to be a little bit brushed out of the historical record. So I think one thing I'm trying to do throughout this book is get people to think about the what ifs. You know, what if Lenin had survived? Had not survived the assassination attempt of Fannia Kaplan in 1918. You know, what if he died? What would have happened then? You know, what would have happened if Stalin had not been successful in essentially shutting out Trotsky, and if Trotsky had taken the helm after the death of Lenin? And one of those characters to me is Rosa Luxemburg, and she was this great Polish Jewish revolutionary who played a major role in the abortive Spartacist, that's to say communist, revolution of 1919. And she had a very, very different conception of what a communist revolution should look like to that of Vladimir Lenin, a much more decentralized one, one where the dictatorship of the party was much less essential. And I think it's interesting to imagine what would have happened if, say, Rosa Luxemburg's brand of revolution had been successful, and Lenin's had not. Would that experiment have played out differently? Would we have a different view of the merits or horror of communism as a result?
These were years of extraordinary violence, weren't they?
I mean, they really were, and not just in, You know, one conflict which is often, and I think, forgotten in the UK, somewhat ironically, is the Anglo-Irish War and the Irish Civil War. And I found the intimacy of that violence. There's a great historical record that the Bureau of Military History, which are these various interviews conducted by the Irish state in the 1940s of those who'd fought in the Anglo-Irish War and in the Irish Civil War. And these are all online. And you read these very, very personal accounts of, conflicts in a little village, you know, these attacks on a pub, people who knew each other engaging in conflict. And so you get a sense of the intimacy that these conflicts could often have. And at the same time, which is quite far removed from, you know, the huge scale and numbers and mechanization of the First World War itself. So you have a huge amount of violence, continuum of violence, really, which stretches from 1917 through the early 1920s, or from the war through the early 1920s. But often it's a violence of a different quality, of a different nature, sometimes more extreme, sometimes more intimate, sometimes less bounded by convention, because there isn't military law at play. There are elements of revenge, for example, which come into it. And these seep very, very deep into the European polity.
Given the extent and the nature of this violence, is there much lightness in the book? Did you try to find the kind of the humour in these stories?
Well, I mean, yes, I do, because I want people to have a laugh, and I hope if people read the book, they will find plenty of humour, because there is, of course, humour in life, and there is something very, very there's an awful lot of absurdity in what happens in this period, and there's a lot of there's a lot of things not going as people expect. There's a lot of chance, and a lot of these characters are tremendously pompous, and so there's one wonderful phrase, which is in the Fiume adventure, when Gabriele D'Annunzio, who's this extraordinary poet, aviator, propagandist for Italian nationalism, and not liking the way in which the peace terms are panning out in Paris, he invades the town of Fiume, which has a mixed population, and tries to claim it for Italy. So this very, very sort of grand theatrical act. And Benito Mussolini acts as his propagandist behind the scenes in Milan. And D'Annunzio says, why is it that you haven't been able to create a revolution in Italy? Why is it that I've done this great thing in Fiume and you haven't been able to overturn the Italian government? And he says, and D'Annunzio writes to Mussolini, why don't you prick your belly to let some of the air out? So you have these extraordinary phrases, which are in the diaries or in the letters of various characters. They're pretty funny. And I think pricking some of the pomposity of some of these characters is also something I'm keen to do.
Why did you decide to end the book in 1924 specifically?
Well, there are lots of reasons. I mean, one big reason is that 1924 is in fact the first year that there is not a war on the European continent. So it is a natural place to end, because up to then you've got the war between the Greco-Turkish War, you've got the Russian Civil War, these other conflicts, but also this is the year in which Lenin dies, and around the same time Woodrow Wilson dies as well. So those two ideas, one of world revolution, communist revolution, and the other of a new world created on, if you like, the principles of, Wilsonian liberal order. Those two ideologies, those two ideas, have really died by 1924. Not completely died, but they're very much on the way out. They've been replaced by other things. They've been replaced by other characters as well. They've been replaced by Hitler. They've been replaced by Stalin. It does seem a natural point to close off that particular era of European history, and then of course you get into the roaring 1920s. But underneath the surface of things, fascism, communism, modern anti-Semitism have really got into Europe and America by that time. The world has changed. And it doesn't take much, 5 years later, 10 years later, with the Great Depression and with the rise of Nazism, again, for these things to reemerge. And I think that really structures European history for the next 20 years.
Is this then what you would see as the start of the West collapse from the inside?
It is absolutely the start of the collapse of the West. Indeed, the one of the best voices on that actually is a Chinese philosopher called Yan Fu, who was writing in 1919, and he was describing how the war showed how Europe had basically collapsed into, what did he say, shameless selfishness and slaughter. And so it's not just the fact that there's a lack of confidence in the West about the West. You get that with, you know, books like Oswald Spengler writes a book called The Decline of the West in These Years, which is tremendously popular in Germany. But also outside the West, in the various empires of the European powers, the notion that somehow Europe represents progress, the future, modernization, that Europe is the example to be looked up to, that's very much not the case after the First World War. And so you start getting, and I don't really go into it very much in the book, although I do discuss the Amritsar massacre of 1919, is you do begin to get empires falling apart, fraying at the edges, because they've lost their claimed moral right to rule. So it's happening at both ends, if you like.
Mm. We're heading now towards the end of this decade. To what extent do the echoes of the period you write about still manifest themselves today in today's world?
Well, I mean, there's one very there are various issues described in the book. So, for example, you know, looking at the Anglo-Irish War and the Irish Civil War, you know, we're obviously still dealing with the echoes of that, because we're still dealing with the consequences of Irish independence and Irish partition. We're also dealing with the way in which the Middle East was divided in the peace settlements after the First World War. Indeed, we're dealing with, you know, if you look at Ukraine, and again, this is the Ukrainian independence. Their first try was in these years. I was traveling earlier this year in Hungary, and in the entire narrative of Viktor Orban's government in Hungary is based on the way in which Hungary was greatly reduced in size after the First World War. And that narrative of grievance is absolutely key to the current Hungarian government. So that's part of it. But I think also we're living through similar times in the sense of perhaps a consensus around the way in which society ought to operate, the sort of the balance of power within society. I think that if there was a broad consensus around, you know, the relationship between the economy and society, for example, that's really frayed at the edges and beginning to fall apart in our times. Mm. And if we look back at these times when there was, you know, an even more dramatic collapse, then we can see the similarities there. And also the rise of populist strongmen, because that's one of the key issues of this time, 1917 to 1924, is the rise of these populists in different varieties across Europe and indeed and to some degree in America.
Does writing history as journalism, almost kind of in the present tense, shift how you see or how we should see historical change, the wider forces of historical development? Do you think we need to rethink the forces that shape historical change in light of this approach?
Well, I think people should view history as being exciting. They should view it as being relevant. And they should also view it as not a, how can I put this? But one advantage of writing in the present tense is to say, you know, it wasn't a done deal at the time. These, you know, things could have come from left field and entirely old, maybe not entirely, but certainly altered the course of events. So I think there's a story there also of chance, but also a story of agency as well. And I think it's important for people to, looking back at history, not to view it simply as being the product of these great immovable forces, which no one can possibly alter, but it is the result also of chance and of individuals making decisions one way or the other, to do things or not do things. And I think that's a, I think that's an important, if you like, quite positive message out of what is otherwise a very dramatic and destructive but also creative era of European history.
That was Charles Emerson. His book, Crucible, The Long End of the Great War and the Birth of a New World, 1917 to 1924, is out now, published by Bodley Head. You can find plenty more on 20th century history from across the globe at our website, historyextra.com. Thanks for listening. Today's podcast was produced by Ben Hewitt and Jack Bateman. Tune in next on Monday, the 23rd of December, for our annual festive podcast quiz.